From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a Michigan-born expert on the Middle East on the challenges for our next president.
You can isolate or try to contain extremists or defeat them, but that, at the end of the day, doesn't kill the ideas that have fueled a lot of these movements.
Remembering a long-gone Flint neighborhood bulldozed in the name of urban renewal.
People help each other. You know, no one really was hurting for anything because people shared. They had a sense of camaraderie.
The Michigan women who kept baseball alive during World War II as they played pro baseball.
I mean, every little girl that plays sports in the United States today, in my opinion, owes a debt of gratitude to these amazing women because they proved it could be done.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. She began as a student at the University of Michigan, where she was the first female sports editor in the history of the Michigan Daily. Robin Wright has gone on to become a widely known and honored foreign affairs analyst, journalist, and author. She's a frequent contributor to The New Yorker, and she's written many books, including her latest, Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. This coming Thursday, Robin Wright returns to Ann Arbor to give the Margaret Waterman Alumni Lecture at the Michigan Union. She's here with us now. Robin, welcome to Stateside.
Go Blue. It's great to be with you.
Good to have you with us. Robin, as we have seen during this presidential campaign season, there is so much fear, there's alarm among many Americans when it comes to the Middle East. Yet, as you talk to people here, Robin, how much do people really know and understand about the Middle East, the war in Syria, about ISIS?
Well, the Middle East is not only the most volatile area of the world, it's also the most complicated. It has a host of religions. It is, of course, a region that dates back to all the Abrahamic faiths, and everyone wants a claim to part of its land and part of its history and also part of its future. It's particularly controversial right now because you have a number of different trends playing out. There's the Arab-Israeli conflict, which dates back more than a half century. There's the issue of from the Arab Spring in 2011 of Arabs trying to oust autocrats and create political alternatives. And then, of course, you have the biggest national security threat and most complicated threat to the United States right now, and that's the war against the Islamic State, which is a extremist movement that has now absorbed about a third of Iraq and a third of Syria and redrawn the Middle East borders. And those three conflicts are actually the simple version.
Robin, you just got back from the Middle East, and here we are about to choose our next president. What do you think that next president's role should be in the Middle East?
Well, the challenges in the Middle East for any president, and every president since the end of World War II has faced the challenges there, is really to figure out a way to balance American values of democracy and freedom and inclusion and women's rights and minority rights with issues of stability. And it's always been the great challenge for many American presidents. Stability has been the preference, in part because of America's dependence on oil. That's, of course, beginning to change because of America's growing independence for energy resources. But, you know, the challenge is trying to figure out a way that those who are insecure about their futures, who feel marginalized or excluded, can feel that they are part of the solution. You know, there are no real military solutions. You can isolate ISIS. You can isolate or try to contain extremists or defeat them. But that, at the end of the day, doesn't kill the ideas that have fueled a lot of these movements. And so the problem is, how do you help people in the region create their own alternatives? We tried after the war in Iraq to come up with solutions for the Iraqi people, and it didn't work. It will probably be judged historically as the greatest mistake in U.S. foreign policy. The question is, what does it take to find solutions that will stabilize the region, that will make people feel politically, socially, and economically included, that their interests and their survival is guaranteed? And you think we're afraid, people who live in the region feel just as afraid at a lot of different levels, and it's overcoming that fear. And after so many decades of conflict, the solution in the future. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be fast.
President Obama has certainly taken heat for the way he's handled the Syrian conflict. Earlier this year, we saw 51 State Department diplomats openly criticize the Obama policy in Syria, and they're urging military strikes against the regime of President al-Assad. In your view, is there something or are there things the Obama administration could have or should have done?
There are no appealing options in Syria. They're all bad options. And the question is, which is the least bad? The danger for greater intervention, whether it was creating no-fly zones or providing more weaponry for rebels on the ground, was what Colin Powell called the pottery barn rule. That is, once you break it or once you're involved, you're responsible for the outcome. And we saw what happened in Iraq. We've seen what's happened in Afghanistan. Nothing happens quickly. Solutions aren't easy. And people often resent the United States for trying to impose solutions on them. So the idea of there being an American military option for the war was never really viable.
And yet we have a candidate saying that if he was elected, he would, quote, bomb the hell out of ISIS.
I'm not going to get political. I don't get involved in American politics. I live in Washington, D.C., and frankly, a pox on all their houses. You know, the question is, what are the realistic options in the future? And if it hadn't been for Iraq, we might have had more options in Syria. But the fact is, the whole Middle East is now going through a period where we don't even know whether the states that were defined a century ago by France and Britain will actually be able to be sustained, whether we may see at the end of the end of this process a redrawing of the Middle East map. It's quite possible. It's clear that there has been long-standing resentment, that there are people who, not just in the last 5 years or 10 years, but for, you know, since the beginning of this process, have felt that whether it's the outside world or the local governments, have not treated them fairly. So these are, you know, big, big issues. We tend to look at the day-to-day headlines and say, what can we do about Aleppo? What can we do about getting ISIS out of Iraq? These are the immediate problems. The bigger issues are really the ones we're going to eventually have to deal with. And those ultimately are not just military. Even though we probably will be able at some point to push ISIS, the Islamic State, out of most of its territory, the question is, what happens to the idea, the alienation that fueled it? And those are the bigger things that will help prevent ISIS from coming back in another form. Remember, Al-Qaeda was, in many ways, a starting point for this process. Al-Qaeda then grew in franchises across the region. One of those was in Iraq. That group then morphed into the Islamic State. And what we have to try to prevent is this phenomena from morphing into 3.0.
I'm interested in your thoughts as we see the refugee crisis, we see the heartbreaking images of people fleeing the conflict. Well, knowing what you do, Robin, about the war in Syria and the refugees fleeing that war, what do you say to people here in the States, here in Michigan, like our governor, who wants to slow down welcoming refugees for fear that they pose a security risk?
The United States has the toughest immigration system in the world when it comes to vetting, particularly from people in that region, for the very reasons that the public fears, that there will be some seepage, that among the refugees there will be some extremists. It's very hard, however, to get a visa to the United States, and the United States has been much more limited in the percentage of refugees it takes. The vast majority of these people are innocent civilians who have fled a conflict. More than 60% of the country is now dependent on international aid just to get a daily meal. Almost 5 million people have left the country altogether, this in a population of only about 20 million. You have over half the population that has fled internally in some form. So we're talking about the greatest humanitarian disaster since World War II. And this is a great country. I'm kind of ashamed as an American that we haven't been more generous in bringing the women, the children particularly, the elderly, the injured, to the United States and giving them a sense of hope and showing how generous we are and what a role model we are as a melting pot for the world.
Foreign Affairs journalist, analyst, author Robin Wright will be back home in Ann Arbor to give the October 13th Margaret Waterman Alumni Lecture. It's a town hall from 11:30 to 1:30 at the Michigan Union Ballroom. What kind of questions, Robin, are you looking forward to getting from your audience?
I'll take any question, and I'm thrilled about being back in Ann Arbor.
Robin, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
America is changing. Non-whites now make up a majority of kindergartners. By the next presidential election, the Census Bureau predicts they will be a majority of all children. And by 2044, no one racial group will be a majority in this country. This cross-current of demographic and cultural change is really upending traditional voting patterns, and it's straining the fabric of just what it means to be American. Throughout this election season, NPR and its member stations have been having a collective national conversation. It's called A Nation Engaged. It looks at central themes in this year's election, including this week's question, what does it mean to be American? For our contribution to the project, we put this question to some promising young spoken word artists. This excerpt is from a poem entitled Kitchen, after Rumi's Guest House. It's by Kendall Flowers, a 17-year-old student at Ann Arbor's Pioneer and Community High Schools.
There is too much blood and earth caked onto my scalp. My grandmother tried to wash it away in the kitchen sink until she recognized some of the bodies in the dirt. It gets heavier. Every day a new tragedy makes a home on my head. Drips blood into my eyes, turns everything red. I pick my hair out. Try to make space for them in all of this thick. And I would be grateful for whoever comes, if each had been sent as a guide from beyond, but I would much rather them be guides here. Playing with toy guns and selling cigarettes on the corner, walking home and listening to music, I want to pour the blood back into the bodies, the air back into the lungs, reset the bones, and none of this ever happened. How does it feel? To wake up light? To be the carried and not the carrier, to taste freedom and not to also taste blood, salt, sweat, to have it go down easy, to sing the national anthem and not choke on it, to watch the flag and not the rope, to see blue and not see red on black.
That was an excerpt from Kitchen, after Rumi's Guest House, written and performed by Kendall Flowers, a student at Pioneer and Community High Schools in Ann Arbor. You can read and listen to her poem in its entirety on our Stateside page. Just go to michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Amidst the torrent of headlines about Flint's water calamity, it's way too easy to lose track of the long history of the city. There are powerful and poignant lessons to be learned in the way that rich, vibrant neighborhoods were taken apart and plowed under in the name of development. Communities like the old St. John Street neighborhood. Charles Winfrey grew up in that community. These days, he's executive director of the new McCree Theater. Charles Winfrey, welcome to Stateside.
It is my pleasure.
Charles, this St. John Street neighborhood is really seen as a prime example of urban renewal that did just the opposite. It really gutted and depleted the city, didn't it?
Yeah, I guess you could call it urban renewal run amok, because it really just displaced families, uprooted them, you know, took them away from their familiarity, their relationships. It did a lot more harm than it did good.
And we know the city in 1972 started buying property and moving people and businesses out from the St. John area. But I want to go back to well before that and get a sense of the history of this neighborhood. First of all, just where is the St. John Street neighborhood and how big, how many blocks are we talking?
Well, simply put, it stretches from Hamilton Avenue on the south to Stewart Avenue on the north. And it was bounded by the Pier Marquette Railroad on the west and the Flint River on the east. So it was a small sliver. It was an international community. It housed immigrants from Hungary, Turkey, Yugoslavia. Of course, the Native Americans were already here, African Americans. It was truly originally an international community.
And what did it come to mean to the black community as the 20th century wore on?
Back in that era, as General Motors began to grow and to seek labor, of course, more and more African Americans came from the South. in search of work. However, once arriving in Flint, they were relegated to only a couple of places, you know, where they were allowed to either rent or purchase property. And one of those places happened to be the St. John Street area, and the other was on the south end of Flint, the Floral Park area. They had very few choices as to where they could live once arriving in Flint, you know, to take advantage of the labor market.
So it's fair to say that it was the heart of Flint's African-American community.
It was. It was a very thriving community. You know, it was a self-contained community. You didn't really have to leave the community to get what you needed, you know, for your everyday living.
And you grew up there, and I would imagine, Charles, a colorful, dynamic community has some colorful, interesting characters.
Oh, yeah. We were living in an apartment building, and across the hall from our apartment was this lady that they referred to as Slap God Almighty. Legend has it that the way she got her name is a police officer, I guess, stopped her on St. John Street. And she asked him, well, you know, what are you stopping me for? And she sort of, I guess, slapped him, you know. And the police officer said, what did you do that for? I'm a police officer. Don't you know who I am? She said, well, I'll slap God Almighty. And so the name sort of stuck. And from that point on, people just referred to her as Slap God Almighty. I mean, there are a lot of other colorful characters. There was Pawn Shop Shorty, who was one of the homeless people in the neighborhood, but he didn't seem to have a care in the world. It was just full of, you know, exciting characters.
And we know then St. John Street was in the way of what was seen as urban renewal plans, and starting in 1972, the city of Flint started buying property and moving people and businesses out. I saw one figure, 1,470 separate parcels were bought or condemned for that neighborhood. What did they do then with that neighborhood, Charles?
Well, the plan, number one, the expressway 475, you know, was going to cut through portions of the St. John Street area. And secondly, they wanted to construct an industrial park. So that was the rationale behind the removal.
I've got to imagine when you think about the neighborhood you knew growing up and you look at what was lost when the city came in with its urban renewal plans, where that sign that said demolition means progress. What do you think was lost? I mean, what did losing that neighborhood do to not only to Flint, but we saw the story repeated, say, in Detroit in the Black Bottom neighborhood and other Rust Belt cities with vibrant African-American neighborhoods?
Well, you know, you lose your, you know, your connectedness, you know, and that was one of the things that was really unique about the St. John Street community. Everybody knew everybody. There was a connectedness throughout the area, and it stretched from Hamilton Street to Stewart Avenue. You know, I could go through now and name people who lived on every street. I can still name everyone who was in my sixth grade class. You know, it was that kind of relationships, I mean, profound relationships. People helped each other. You know, no one really was hurting for anything, because people shared, they had a sense of camaraderie. It was such a unique, warm and heartfelt community. And, you know, we had our problems, you know, people would carouse and, you know, there was prostitution, but that was all part of the flavor, you know, and it was all, you know, part of that whole St. John dynamic. You know, we didn't differentiate. I mean, they were part of the community. So that was lost. And I think, you know, I can't remember ever having the kind, and maybe this is just my childhood speaking, but I can't remember having that kind of relationship in any neighborhood since then, you know, and I've lived in several.
Do you ever let yourself wonder, you know, what if that neighborhood, the St. John Street neighborhood, had stayed rich and strong and intact? How do you think Flint might be different today?
Well, you know, that's a complex question because on the one hand, the housing, you know, when we moved in, the housing was deteriorating. Some would say it was substandard. The General Motors plant was pouring soot over the neighborhood, damaging property, and I'm sure people had all kinds of COPD problems. I know I had an uncle who was a tuberculosis patient because of that. and there was a high incidence of tuberculosis and other asthmatic types of illnesses during that time in that area. You know, so there was some negatives, but I'm still convinced that removing the people was bad. But then you have all these other forces, you know, that you have to take into consideration.
Charles Winfrey, executive director of the new McCree Theater in Flint, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and memories of the Old St. John neighborhood with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Director Penny Marshall's 1992 film, A League of Their Own, put the spotlight on a pretty unique period in American culture and sports history, the time when professional baseball was played by girls when the men were off fighting World War II. And of course, that's when we all learned what crusty manager Jimmy Dugan, played by Tom Hanks, thought about crying and baseball.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris. Rogers Hornsby was my manager, and he called me a talking pile of pig. And that was when my parents drove all the way down from Michigan to see me play the game. And did I cry?
No.
No. No. And you know why?
No.
Because there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball. No crying.
Well, that was Hollywood's look at the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. That there is a strong Michigan side to the story of this league. The Muskegon Lassies, the Kalamazoo Lassies, Grand Rapids Chicks, Battle Creek Bells, and Muskegon Bells all played at one time in the league. My guest today tells their stories in a documentary called A Team of Their Own. Frank Boring is an affiliate professor in the School of Communications at Grand Valley State University. Welcome, Frank.
Thank you very much for having me.
This league was the idea of Philip Wrigley, wasn't it? And that it existed.
Chewing gum. Yep,
chewing gum Wrigley.
He also owned ballparks in Los Angeles and in New York. And so he had actually seen that the women's baseball sometimes outdrew, or actually women's softball, sometimes outdrew the men. And so the idea that baseball might actually fail in 1943 because the men were going off to war, he thought, well, let's see if we can do it with women.
And what got you thinking about the young Michigan women who played?
Well, I was brought here back in 2003 as a documentary filmmaker. I'm actually not a PhD. I don't have really an academic background. I'm at Grand Valley because of my professional background. And I started the Library of Congress Veterans History Project here, of which we now have over 1,200 interviews at Grand Valley. But the Library of Congress Veterans History Project was an attempt to get interviews with veterans, either through oral history, documented with video is the way I did it. And so I found that there was four remaining Grand Rapids Chicks. And so I contacted the Library of Congress Veterans History Project director, and I said, I'd like to include these women in the Library of Congress. And he said, well, I don't know if that really fits in the Veterans History Project. And I said, well, if Rosie the Riveter can be in the Library of Congress, then Rosie the Right Fielder should be. And sure enough, he did. I did those four interviews, and within 2 weeks, one of them had passed away.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, you know, if somebody doesn't do this, it's going to be gone forever. And so 10 years later, 47 interviews later, we not only have them as part of the Library of Congress, our national history, these women are now part of our national history, but there's a documentary film produced at Grand Valley.
And you made students such an integral part of this effort, didn't you?
Absolutely. One of the things when I came here as an independent filmmaker, my first film cost $400,000. That was on the Flying Tigers, and it aired nationally on PBS. I came here and I realized, wait a minute, I don't have to rent any equipment. They've got all the state-of-the-art cameras, equipment, editing, and guess what? There's people that know how to use this stuff. So I integrated a model in which history students did the research, the film and video students shot the interviews and did the editing, and then marketing and public relations literally planned out how it's going to be seen across the country and came up with a media kit and all that. And then the IT people created the website and created the Twitter account and the Facebook account. So it's basically replicating what a real documentary filmmaker would have to do without having to raise $400,000.
Oh, well, the work is exquisite. Let's take a quick listen to some of this documentary, A Team of Their Own.
My dad was reading the paper, and he said to me, there's an all-American baseball, girls' baseball league that's having tryouts, and it's going to be right in the neighborhood.
We had a strong passion for the game. Everybody was trying to do their best and trying to make the team. You knew what you had to compete against. You knew what you had to beat.
Let's switch to some activity on a little more glamorous scale. These girls look like a group of college co-eds, but as you see them now, they are the South Bend, Indiana, entry in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League.
And that is from the documentary, A Team of Their Own, telling the Michigan side of the story of the World War II-era All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, produced by a team led by my guest, Frank Boring of the School of Communications at Grand Valley State University. Frank, what was the overall story that you uncovered through these nearly 50 interviews?
Well, I think the key thing is that if you love the movie, and believe me, I love the movie. I've seen it probably 8 times and just watched individual scenes. But this really tells the true story. For one thing, and I hope all your listeners are sitting down. I don't want to be falling over and hurting themselves.
Okay.
There was no crying in baseball. The women were very adamant about that. In fact, in the film itself, we included 2 of the women who said that they never saw anybody crying. They were baseball players. But now they've embraced that so much that they actually, if you go to a reunion, and I've been to 3 now, I'm going to the 4th one in Florida, they have T-shirts now that say, there's no crying at baseball. So the other thing was that they started playing underhand, and it evolved into overhand, whereas the movie, the Penny Marshall movie, starts out with them trying out actually playing baseball. But what they're known for is the fact that they actually did play on a field with the same equipment that the men played eventually. But in the very first couple of years or so, it was underhand.
And these were very young women, weren't they, when they had it off to play?
15, 16 years old, 17, 18. The oldest was probably in their early 20s. Mm. And that's why they had the chaperones. I mean, that's why Wrigley, you know, had these women looking out after them, because they were afraid that these are young girls, you know, you're going to send them to Chicago. It's dangerous. One of the women said in an interview, says he told her mother she wanted to go there. She goes, you're going to Chicago? That's where Al Capone is. There's no women baseball players. He's probably up to something over there. But yeah, the chaperones were literally to take care of them. And we cover all of that. The beauty of this film is it really gives you an inside view, walking in the shoes of these girls. We literally have you at when they tried out, how they tried out, how they heard about it, and then getting on the trains and on the buses and going out to these different places, and then how it eventually evolved into baseball. So it's really a beginning, middle, and end, you'll understand, about the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League.
Do we have a sense how many are left?
This is going to sound morbid, but I get emails on a regular basis that another one is gone, but my historians could tell you the exact number. I don't remember exactly. But there were 10 teams and over the period of 1943 to 1954. So there was a lot of them. The ones that we got and the ones that was so desperate for me to get several years ago were the ones that started in 43. And all of them are gone now. But I have their stories for the Library of Congress. And that's one of the things that I'm very proud about my team and about the people that worked on this, that we saved those stories before they were gone.
It is so important to get those oral histories and the interviews from that World War II generation, as you say, before they are gone. Yeah. This must have been transformative, talking with these women, making this film with you for the students on your team.
It was for me and for the students. I think that when you are a film and video student or you're a marketing, advertising, event planning student, In school, you plan these projects. They're almost like pretend projects. They're class projects. This one, they knew from the very beginning that this was an important project to work on, that was going to be something they're going to take with them for the rest of their lives. And they'll be able to tell their children, their grandchildren, that they actually preserved the story of one of the most remarkable pieces of American history, not just sports history.
Right.
And another thing that I thought that was very, to go back to your original question, almost every one of these women, when they finally did leave, had earned enough money to go to college. Some of them had extraordinary careers. A lot of them started baseball or basketball or golf programs in their communities. And I think an argument could be made that they were really the pioneers of what eventually became Title IX. I mean, every little girl that plays sports in the United States today, in my opinion, owes a debt of gratitude to these amazing women because they proved it could be done.
Well, you can find out more information on future screenings by searching for A Team of Their Own on Facebook. Any other suggested ways for people to loop into what you're up to?
Yeah, if you go to Grand Valley State University's website and type in Veterans History Project, you'll have access to over 1,200 interviews with World War II veterans, Korea veterans, Vietnam veterans, etc. But also there's a special segment there on the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. You can watch the entire interview. Don't have to use a password. It's great for scholars. It's great for future generations of people that want to study this story.
Great work. Frank Boring, Grand Valley State University School of Communications, you and your team of students. Thank you so much for sharing A Team of Their Own with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Coming up on Stateside, self-driving cars could open the roads to people with disabilities. A conversation about inclusion, innovation, and access to transportation. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Opportunities.
Part of the community.
The next idea.
A culture for innovation is a culture with a sense of destiny, a sense of that tomorrow is going to be better than today. That's what the word progress means.
Driverless cars are on the horizon. That much is very clear. We've heard from businesses, engineers, politicians about what this could mean for all of us. Our latest contributors to The Next Idea represent another point of view, people with disabilities. If you can't drive because of physical impairments, neurological impairments, access to transportation is one of the biggest barriers to employment and to social activity. With us now is John Lepetz. He's a senior associate of Lepetz & Associates. It's an automotive alternative fuels consulting group, and he is a longtime advocate of opportunities for people living with disability. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we welcome Kathy McAdam, who's an assistive technology coordinator at the Michigan Disability Rights Coalition. Good to have you with us, Kathy.
Good to be here.
Speaking of the challenges that the disability community has in transportation, it is probably worth noting, Kathy, you are completely blind and you weren't able to make the arrangements to join us in the studio today. And I've got to imagine the idea that one day you could step out and get into an autonomous vehicle and it would bring you right to where you want to be. That has to be absolutely thrilling.
I'm all about that. I think that would be awesome.
Give us a sense of the current challenges. I'll start with you, Kathy. Let's take this a little deeper, that you and other people with disabilities have in just getting around Michigan.
Well, you're about an hour and a half from my home location, so trying to get to you today by bus would have been a horrendous task. And the cost of a cab or even one of the Uber or Lyft cars would have probably been rather significant as well. So it is challenging, and sometimes the distance makes it even more so. And bus transportation has gotten a little bit better with the Americans with Disabilities Act, but it's still quite a challenge. And sometimes you can use a big chunk of the day just getting somewhere by bus.
And in your work, John Lepetz, what have you seen?
Well, I've seen very similar things. At Ford, I was involved in a group that was Ford employees dealing with disabilities, and I have a walking ambulatory disability myself. So you see people face these challenges, and it limits their ability to contribute. They can't be where the work is. They can't necessarily perform in a timely fashion. I mean, many job interviews, one of the first questions is, do you have reliable transportation? And it's a totally legitimate question. I mean, a business needs to know that the workforce can get there. But unfortunately, it becomes a subtle form of discrimination because a lot of people with challenges just simply can't do that.
And I'm interested in what the reaction has been in the disability community as we've seen this steady procession of news that autonomous vehicles, these self-driving cars, are indeed being developed and are being tested. And, you know, they're on the horizon. What has that reaction been like, John?
Well, it's interesting. It's almost, personally, and Kathy may add some color to it, to me it's like a hidden secret, I think, because there's so much excitement about the concept of what we traditionally might think of as the Jetsons situation, where people get into a vehicle and they read their newspaper from the front seat and they just joyously get taken to their destination. But with people with challenges, it's much more subtle than that. The technologies that are involved, maybe you can do certain things, but not on a continuous basis. Maybe you have a challenge that is more like a dementia or something, so you get lost. To me, there are subtle things. The phrase I think of is aging in place, even. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the challenges to me, it's sort of funny. I don't think the most difficult conversation that a child has with their parents is the sex talk. I think it's dad. Your keys are representing a concern for us. You know, we need to take away your keys. Don't worry. Everything will be normal. But in America, this is a huge loss of independence. Huge. And the idea that you could purchase a car and perhaps with some of these enabling technologies, not go from zero to totally autonomous necessarily, mm-hmm. but to begin to use some of these enablers so that you can, I'll say, age in place. And as the car takes over more and more of the responsibilities, the loved ones, the other people, they can then be a little more comfortable knowing that, okay, Grandma can get here for Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. Kathy, what questions or what concerns are on your mind as you think toward a future where you might be behind a wheel or, you know, at least behind a computer, but you have the idea of being able to do what we talked about?
It was actually very interesting as I was preparing for this and actually had written a blog recently that covered across disabilities, because one of the things that dawned on me was, would I even be able to get a license to get in the car to drive it? And that's part of the discussion that's going on as far as autonomous cars. There's even some discussion of who's the driver. Is it the software or is it the person? But for people with disabilities, and I kind of removed myself a little bit because I think for someone who's totally blind, this is certainly a dream I have. But I was thinking about some of my friends with low vision or who have learning disabilities, and the possibilities of this technology are just astounding because you can drive with lenses, kind of like it looks like a telescope for people with low vision. But with some of the technology already available to let you know that you are a certain distance in front of a car or crossing a lane or parallel parking, there's already some phenomenal things happening that's making it possible for people who have a lot of challenges to probably be safer drivers. And it's really an exciting time.
And when you stop and think about the things that we are going, ooh, about, I know when I got a new loaner car, and unlike my current car, it has the little buzzer in the seat that lets you know when you've crossed the line. I'm like, wow, that's cool. But we're really looking at the autonomous vehicle equivalent of black and white television. When you think about what will be coming, we'll be looking back and going, oh, wasn't that quaint that we got excited about technology that let, you know, buzzed my butt when I crossed a line. But it's wonderful. But I'm thinking of the research and development part of things. And, John, since you worked at Ford for many years, how do you think the industry is doing in approaching people with disabilities in their research and development and in their production?
Well, as you know, having been in this this market, it takes a long time to bring new technologies mm-hmm. to market. So you see them coming out, and Kathy sort of alluded to this incrementally. So I think it was in 2010, Lincoln offered the parallel parking option. And now a lot of other cars at different price points have those same kinds of features. The adaptive cruise control, where the vehicle will slow down if you're on cruise and it approaches a vehicle. The blind sight indications. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those technologies are being integrated into the vehicle. I don't know that the auto companies necessarily are, I'll say, identifying those technologies for the challenged population as much as they're trying to integrate them into the full suite of things that any driver would appreciate. But I think the leverage to the challenged driver is much greater because they're already working a little bit from a disadvantage in some of those situations. And I guess one point I'd like to make, because when we talk about autonomous vehicles, I sort of look at them as being in two families. There's the ones which maybe is more akin to the Jetson idea, where the vehicles are literally talking to each other and communicating, and you are sort of in a bubble. That, I think, is much further off just simply because of the infrastructure that's going to be required.
And also, I think it's not only the infrastructure, but also just the driver mindset. I have said this to people who are working in the field, that I think it's going to take, like, my generation. I'm a baby boomer. My generation of drivers to have passed on, in a way, to not be nervous about that, because I don't know that we can undo 40 or 50 years worth of driving experience. And it's going to take, I think, the newer drivers. I don't know. Tell me I'm wrong here, but I think it's going to take kind of a combination of that.
Well, the other aspect is, like, last year, the auto industry built something like 17 million new cars. Yeah. None of those cars, or a very small number of them, are talking to anything. So right now, the second category of vehicles are the ones that are autonomous unto themselves. And
that's way on the horizon.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's the big distinction. So I think you're already seeing, as Kathy alluded, that some of these technologies coming in. And I think it's going to open markets to people that perhaps were on the fence about whether you would get a new vehicle and what features you would look for. I think if you're purchasing a vehicle and you're maybe a more mature driver, and some of the challenges we spoke to, you might look at that and say, you know, between the two vehicles, this one makes me much more comfortable that I'm going to be able to have it for a while, age into it. Maybe a young driver, same thing. You're going out without much experience. So we have an intelligent vehicle now. It can sort of help this young driver provide some wisdom. And I think the automakers are seeing that aspect of it, where they realize that the way the markets are defined, they can appeal to these different demographics by offering these kind of options.
And that's the first kind you're talking about. So that's where things are already being...
That's the transitional phase.
Transitional, perfectly put.
I do have to make a note on the cruise control development, because it was developed by an engineer who was blind. Mm. And I found that really fascinating. And this was a man who also used what they call echolocation. It's a way of walking and using mobility and using a lot of sound location. And I think including people with disabilities who have that kind of talent and bring a different perspective to how we think of driving is going to be very, very important as we move forward. Because, yes, this is going to take time. But I do think that whether it's a mobility issue or a learning disability or the way we think of things differently cognitively, there's all kinds of things that can be benefited as you're looking at new technologies. Technology today has just opened all kinds of doors in so many different ways for people with disabilities, and this is just another avenue to bring that kind of talent forward.
And I know, John, you had shared kind of the idea of, as this is being developed, the importance of hearing from the disability community. You were mentioning that a lot of the vans that were being made for wheelchair users, oh, wait, they didn't actually meet the needs of the people who needed to get around in them. So that's to this point.
No, absolutely. The phrase I used to use is that people need to understand that a minivan is not the aspirational vehicle of the challenged population. Some people, you know, have challenges but from birth, like I do. Some others encounter them in midlife. Some of them have them in varying degrees. You know, as they age, things don't quite work as well. But I think it is important. Ford does have a group that works with the modifiers of companies that take vehicles. But we had a spokeswoman at Ford when I was there. It was a lady, probably, I'm guessing, in her mid-30s, was a race car driver. And her aspirational car was a Mustang. So she raced a Mustang. And, of course, it was fitted with the equipment. But being able to bring that perspective into the industry, it sort of alerts people that these subtle things actually open the door to a market of customers that otherwise you couldn't reach. And I think that's a pretty powerful thing.
Kathy McAdam, if you could make one recommendation to those engineers and those developers working on self-driving vehicles, what would that be?
Oh, my.
She's got so many, she can't even boil it down to one, right?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that's exciting to me about this whole, and I'm not sure that this is going to answer your question, but one of the things that's exciting to me is the safety features that I think are going to make driverless cars or autonomous cars really, I think that's going to move forward the whole discussion of how fast this is going to move forward. Because I do think anybody who is a driver can lose concentration or focus. And having the autonomy to make your transportation safer, that's a really key thing.
What about your recommendation, John?
Well, I would agree with Kathy, is that you need, in any industry, you need something that is the pulling factor. And the idea, we value lives, and you can't put a price on that. So being able to offer safer methods of transportation in an industry like ours is a big deal. The other aspect, I think, that's important, and this is part of what we were trying to accomplish, and I think we did with the Ford employees dealing with disabilities, at least at Ford, was that we brought the voices of a lot of those concerns into the product development community. We made those different employees available. I myself sat on a lot of committees where we would discuss proposed ideas, and just being able to have that dialogue brings in, as Kathy mentioned, different perspectives. And you solve the problems differently, but then from the other side of solving the problems, you begin to better understand those challenges, and you make the products just inherently much more viable for that population.
If we hit this holy grail that we've been discussing, the idea that people with disabilities can use autonomous vehicles to get around, Kathy, what changes do you think people will start to see in their communities in Michigan through that?
Well, you'll see much more inclusion in so many aspects of life. I mean, just getting, let's say I want to join a choir and be able to be at meetings on a regular basis, and I don't have transportation to get there. I mean, it can be as simple as recreation. But recreation also leads to socialization, which, you know, and of course employment to me is one of the keys. And John touched on this, but there were so many times I was asked if I have a driver's license before I even got to an interview. Mm-hmm. And to answer that honestly on an application form, I was going to leave myself out of an interview. So it's about employment, it's about recreation, it's hard to describe to people who drive and do it just as a routine of their daily life what's missing when you can't.
So true. Your thoughts, John. What would it mean for our communities?
Well, to me, it almost gets personal, but I think it's almost like a self-esteem enabler, because if you can't get to where you want to go, you begin to stop doing the things you like to do. And so much in America, so much of this is that personal independence of transportation. Other countries, my daughter just came back from Europe, public transportation there is fairly broad. It's much easier when I've been there myself, moving around. In America, the distances are greater. But even beyond that, it is that personal independence of I want to go to the store by myself at this minute. And if you can't do those things, that loss of independence, you regress into the house, you don't have the social connections, you stop believing that there are things that you could do, you just don't put yourself out there. So, I know self-esteem is a powerful word, and we use it a lot of times, but I think it's something that if you don't have any boundaries, that challenge is a little bit different. The minute you have boundaries imposed, then it really restricts things. And as Kathy said, you don't know that until you've lost it. And at that point, it's a whole different story.
Kathy McAdam and John Lopez representing the views of the disability community and looking at this idea of autonomous cars, autonomous vehicles. It was really great to have both of you with us on The Next Idea. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for letting us talk about this exciting topic.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstrom. Today's show is directed by Mercedes Mejia. Contributors are Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Allie Billings, Liz Dickey, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.